parts of television production changed practically overnight when COVID-19 began to spread in the United States in March of last year. One corner of TV that's carried on is the late-night talk comedy show. There have been no live audiences and in some cases no studios in use, but projects like Showtime's Desus and Mero have carried on nonetheless. I'm Linda Holmes, and today on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're talking about what it's like to write and produce a late-night talk show during the pandemic. So don't go away.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Welcome to banking reimagined. Capital One checking and savings accounts have no fees or minimums and a top-rated banking app that lets you manage your money anytime, anywhere. Check on the account balance, deposit checks, pay bills, and transfer money on the go. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome back. Joining us from his home in New York is stand-up comedian Josh Gondelman. Josh is the host of the podcast Make My Day and the author of the essay collection Nice Try. He's also a writer and producer for the Showtime talk show Desus and Mero. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, thank you for having me. So nice to see you, Linda.
It is so nice to see you. You know, you were on this show visiting with us a few years ago,
yeah. But
it's been a while, and it was before you got this awesome gig running this awesome show, and then we had this very unusual year for television production. How did you get everybody set up technically? I know you talked a little bit about the equipment, but what's that process like, making sure everybody has everything that they need?
I mean, our post department did an amazing job, and it was like a lot of like stuff was selling out too, because I think just like, oh, I need this mic at home, and there's a run on podcast mics the same way there is with toilet paper.
Oh, for sure.
So it was, yeah, it was seeing what was available, seeing what we needed to send to first Desus and Mero so that like there could be cameras and mics on them
right. At
their homes. And then our producer, Julia Young, who is amazing, who talks to the guys and you hear her voice throughout the show. She had to get some stuff upgraded. And then it was like, do the editors have to have better Wi-Fi to get these huge files in and out? You know, so it like there were all these little levels that had to be taken care of beyond like, okay, can we see the hosts and hear them on camera? Because there are so many different moving parts. Like then Desus and Mero themselves kind of had to become tech experts, like recording themselves at first and sending these big files to our assistant editors to prep or associate editors to prep, and then sending them to the editors to work on. And I'm now, when we shoot remotely, like on Zoom calls with one editor all day, and Julia is on with another editor all day, just like getting the pieces into shape. So it is like, it's an incredible technical marvel. And our post-production department just did like such a truly unbelievable job. I want to say heroic, but I feel like doctors might get mad. But I do feel like as far as television production, it is heroism.
Yeah. How do you think it has changed the show not to have the audience?
I think we are fortunate in that so much of the rhythm of the show is dictated by Desus and Mero, and then Julia's kind of interplay with them as well. But I mean, so much of it is driven by Desus's reaction to Mero, Mero's reaction to Desus. And there aren't like built-in laugh lines that they know they're going to have to pause through. Like they just kind of move at their own pace.
And they have a long history in podcasting and stuff, right? So they've done this before as kind of them bouncing off of each other.
Absolutely. Right. So they have the Bodega Boys podcast that they're still doing. We had the very fortunate set of circumstances where like the hosts of our show are used to performing to each other, and they're like great at it, and it feels so natural for them to do.
Yeah. It's also been a year, I think, where just in general comedy is complicated, I'm just going to say, just because it has been a year when people really have needed to rely on things that are funny and fun, but where, you know, concentrating on those things has not always been easy, I think. Tonally, how have you sort of dealt with making a mostly light and fun show in a difficult period of all of our lives?
I think in a way, it's like easier to know what's funny because you definitely know what's not funny this year. Mm-hmm. And I think like we want to talk about what's relevant to people's lives, right? And what everybody is thinking about all the time. And so with the pandemic stuff, there has been, for throughout most of the year, people saying ridiculous things about it. While we were still in the studio, this artist, this music artist called named Yofran Hell, put out a series of like coronavirus pop songs with these videos. One of him is in the back of an ambulance, and it's just like, okay, this is so ridiculous to the point that like it bears commenting on. It's fun to like riff on. I think the mission statement of our show, not to put words in anyone else's mouth, is more to comment on what's in culture. And so I think like it was a little easier lift than maybe some of the other shows had, where you have to like look down the barrel of like, you know, hard medical realities. Whereas we're like, Rudy Giuliani looks like he's melting. That's just something that
you always
and it's like, we're just gonna like go in on that. And plus there was a culture drought for a while, I think, like towards the beginning of the pandemic, where all the news was just coronavirus, it felt like. Like even the election took a huge backseat. And then by like May, it felt like things are starting to happen that you can talk about, like local news stories even that you can riff on, that kind of thing. And I also think like during the part of the year that felt the like heaviest and then the hardest to make light of, which to me was like the really necessary and widespread Black Lives Matter protests throughout June specifically, we were off the air. So we fortunately didn't have like to immediately go, okay, is there something funny about this? And when we came back, we talked to an NFL player who had been arrested at a protest, and I think looked at some things very sincerely, but I think looking for the stuff that was funny on its face to like kind of tee off on and focus on.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you know this, Josh, but you are a white dude.
I've heard.
Yeah. And you know, you are working as a producer and writer on a show with very beloved Black hosts. Mm-hmm. And I think that has a very devoted Black audience. And it's interesting to hear that to be reminded that you were not on the air at that time. But what has this really heavy year been like for you, kind of navigating that job? Do you think it has felt different to you than, you know, a previous job like your job on John Oliver's show or something like that would have felt?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think one way that I have been able to react to this, and this is like a real privilege, is I think if I'd been working for a white host, there would have to be kind of like layers of like, ooh, what is it our place to say? But I kind of feel like I had the privilege of like taking cues from the hosts of the show. And so not feeling like I have to like take the lead and instead use my experience and skills as a writer and producer to like facilitate the things that the hosts want to say or that members of the writing staff or production team think we should move to the forefront, which is nice. I don't have to be like, oh, what should I think about this? I can be like, oh, I can like people who have a more immediate and relevant and necessary reaction, I can kind of work in support of that. And even the kind of adjacent stuff that was not specifically like protest related or police violence related. Like we did what I thought was a really great interview with the musical artist Lady A, who was involved in this dispute with the former Lady Antebellum, who changed their name to Lady A without checking to be like, is that already a person? And she is. and she was amazing. Like watching her interview and watching Jesus and Mara like respond to her and ask questions of her was really cool. And like, it was just a perspective that I'm so glad that I got to be like a little part of like bringing that to TV by just like helping edit that, you know what I mean? And try to keep in the things that I was like, wow, this really kind of blew my hair back. And I think this people will really respond to this.
Yeah. As a writer, how is it different for you when all the writers are not kind of able to be in the same place physically? Is it different for you writing in that kind of collaborative environment, but with a different kind of setup?
It is a little different. I mean, we just like miss being together, I think. I really love our staff. It's just full of wonderful people and wonderful writers. And I think there's like a real energy to like pitching stuff in the same room and working on it together. And our staff is very small and the writer's room is everybody kind of in a room all the time. And so it's very easy when you're like working on something to go like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, and just like look to your left, look to your right. It's like harder to do those kind of like gut checks, joke checks, like, hey, is this anything? I feel like there's no one to ask that to more of the time.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to be more intentional about like seeking collaborative work. And my boss, Mike Palasek, who's our head writer, has been really great at being like, hey, if you're working on this, feel free to grab someone else in a Zoom and like bounce ideas together. But one thing I think that we were able to do, or that this situation of working remotely kind of forced us into, was we found all sorts of like really interesting and new ways to produce segments for the show. Like, Jesus and Mara do a lot of like man on the street stuff, and that's really fun getting them out. They love to like get out in the street, talk to people, riff with people, just like see who's around. But we did those as man on the couch segments, so we could talk to anyone anywhere, which was really cool. And we brought in a bunch of really interesting people for various different segments we were doing. And we did a lot of like, we set up green screens in the guy's house and we had them do like silly character stuff. But this is like, they're in their own houses. Everybody's very comfortable. It feels like low risk, you know, where there's not like a whole team. And it's also, this is how we can produce a sketch. You know, we can produce it via green screen. There's no option to just like do the real thing. If we want them to look like they're in a parlor making music, we did like a fake versus battle of like classical musicians. And it was so much fun. Heaven Nagatu pitched it and wrote it, and it was amazing. And that was a great green screen sketch. And, you know, I think that kind of stuff was enabled by like, okay, I guess we have no choice but to do things this way. Yeah. And some of the results were really fun and exciting.
Yeah, I feel like television and maybe late night even more than a lot of other places can get to that point where the format is kind of running everything. The format is sort of dictating what happens. And it almost seems like being forced to reconsider some elements of that format has led a lot of people kind of, well, what is going to be our version of this, right? Or is it going to be Seth Meyers up in the captain's, whatever he calls it, singing sea shanties to himself? Is it like, what is going to be our particular take on this? Has it felt like there are some freedoms that come with not being able to continue to kind of follow the format that's been established?
Yeah, I think the freedom from kind of having to make everything look exactly like what it is, if that makes sense. Like these green screen sketches that I mentioned were kind of enabled by the fact that like when you're shooting a sketch, a lot of the time, unless you want it to look kind of goofy and like a Conan O'Brien, like mouth over someone else's mouth way,
right,
you want it to look smooth and good and like tone perfect. But because that was just impossible, we were like, okay, we're going to do all this stuff. We're going to have the guys pretending that they're the only two fans in the NBA bubble. And we did that all, like our graphics department just like kept knocking things out of the park all year in just like making it look really fun and bright and cool. But like if the green screen glitches when one of their arms goes up or like out of the frame, it's like, hey, there's a global health emergency. Don't complain about this. This is the least of anyone's problems.
And there's no illusion to shatter because people already don't have that illusion. They know that you're not all hanging out shooting remotes so there's sort of nothing to break. There's no reality to break.
Yeah. And I think we were able to do some really nice and heartwarming stuff too, that like the guys officiated a wedding over Zoom for a couple. And we threw them separate bachelorette parties over Zoom, one with Jesus, one with Mero. And we like we had like strippers for one of them over Zoom, which is like, I was just like, that's very fun to me to kind of like go, hey, let's create this closeness or approximate it as close as we can get. And it was really sweet. And they were fans of the show. And it just felt really nice. Like it felt nice to like any kind of outreach we could do during like this time where everybody felt so alone.
Right.
Even over the over Zoom just felt like really warming and heartening.
Yeah. I do want to ask you one more thing, which is from the point of view of being a stand-up, how are you holding up not performing with crowds of people?
I miss it. I like it and I miss it. I've done one live show. I did one outside live show. And I was very stressed because I've been like very cautious the whole time. And the whole audience was wearing masks. And it was only about 18 people kind of spread out, or 25 people in a backyard in Brooklyn. And I was the only comic that did this, but I kept my mask on to perform even. And everyone's mic had a little mic prophylactic on it that you would peel off after your own set. And I was like, oh, I do like this. Because I have really enjoyed the experience of like being home at night, and I've tried to, instead of focusing on like, I can't do this thing that I love. It's like, oh, well, I get to stay home and I make dinner every night for me and my wife, Maris. And I'm trying to retreat into that a little bit. And that's been really lovely, like that stuff. And I hate saying silver lining because it's like, well, you don't have to wait until 250,000 people die to have dinner at home with your wife. But I do think like I've tried to adapt in a way that feels emotionally healthy and nourishing. And part of that is, I think part of my missing stand-up less is like having this comedy job that I do all day. So when I hit the end of the day, I'm like, great, done. And then starting a podcast, I'm like, oh, I like get to mess around with like comedian friends and writer friends right. for an hour every week. And that's been really helpful.
I hear that. Josh Gondelman, we appreciate so much you coming here to talk to us. People can watch your work on Jesus and Marrow. They can listen to Make My Day. They can buy your book, Nice Try. Anything else they should know?
Oh gosh. I mean, I think that's more than enough. If people do all those things, they'll be like, that's plenty.
Thank you very much, Josh Gondelman. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, my name is Peter Sagal, and I am here to help you with the most pressing problem facing civilization today. There are too many good podcasts to listen to. Now, why not avoid that whole problem by listening to an extremely silly podcast hosted by me? On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's wisecracks about the week's news, shenanigans, fart jokes, and general silliness. And doesn't that sound pretty great right now? Listen to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.